Okay, so it's a real pleasure to be here. I've been to Waterloo, but not to the Perimeter Institute before. So it's nice to be here and see it and meet some people I haven't seen and meet some people I knew from before, actually. So what I want to do is give, or I should preface this, since I have my own view of what Perimeter Institute must be, is I'm an experimentalist, and this is a talk about experiments largely. So it makes it easier to follow maybe for me. So this title, From Supersolidity to Giant Plasticity, is kind of a... It's possible in this field because when people started studying intensively solid helium as a quantum solid, they started about 10 years ago because there was an experiment that showed or was very convincing that you saw a new phase, a supersolid in a crystalline material, something like a superfluid. And I would claim that what we've worked on and recently, I would describe as this. So there's a little bit of sociology in how we got from thinking we had a super solid, and some people certainly believe we still do, to what I think is going on. So just at Alberta, these are a James Day, a student, and Alex Ischenko. So the earlier work I did that I'll describe is really these people's work. And then I was lucky enough a couple years ago to have a sabbatical and went to Paris to work with a different group in Paris. And this is the group. This is Sébastien Balibar, who is the head of the group and a postdoc and a couple students, et cetera, all working there. And the backdrop and the roof is very different than Alberta's. So Ariel Azio is here. And he was the student I worked really closely with in the experiments. I sort of brought my techniques and their techniques. We sort of worked it together. And luckily, Ariel was a fantastic student, just at the ready to get everything done. Okay, so I thought I'd start with something. The supersolidity part, to be honest, is as much more sociology than it is physics. Certainly, it's not the theory. There's a long-standing theoretical argument that helium could be a supersolid. But so this was the start of it as an experimental field, a reinvigoration. And there was two articles by Moses Chan and his student Ensung Kim at Penn State in 2004. This was, there was an argument about the paper whether they should say probable, possible, certain. There's a long argument with the referees, but it came out as probable, very compromised. And then months later, like 8 months later or something, in real, genuine single crystals without any other complications, and here the probable was able to disappear. This is the figure, and I'll explain this. This is just a bunch of curves with colors at this point, but this is the figure that was based on in this paper, which really got the field going. And here's the statement. So in conclusion, the data show that at temperatures approaching absolute zero, the moment of inertia changes and the solid becomes a supersolid, which clearly appears to be a previously unknown state of matter. This actually is not from Moses' paper. Where this statement is from here. That's the same figure. So they didn't even tell Moses they did that. Like, I phoned him and said, "You're famous." He said, "What?" So they just grabbed this off the internet and turned it into an episode of Big Bang Theory. This is Moses, right? That's what he really looks like. Anyway, so with this start, there's a long history before this of theoretical predictions, experimental efforts to find this without any experimental success. So if you take the sociology, just to see where it went, after 2004, if you just take even just one journal and see what they said in their news articles and stuff, it goes from, you know, being flummoxed to mysteries to murky to something quite different, and then to cracking the solid, understanding it, and then it, suddenly in the same year agreeing that it doesn't exist, something else. You know, sort of over those years, everybody, I think, in 2004 thought that by about here we'd have it all understood, and it would be all confirmed or proved wrong. But it kept going, and then if you go to 2010, it didn't get better, right? So in 2010, I mean, it's an enigma. There's evidence for it slipping away. There's evidence for it. There's evidence in rotating helium. This is a classic experiment. And then there's something, nemesis, in other words, some other experimentalist sort of convinced people. And I mean, this, how does it work? This paper in Nature, on the same day, is talking about, I can't remember, they're basically talking about each other's papers in their other journals, and one saying that your paper proves that it isn't, and my paper proves it is, and vice versa. So it wasn't getting any clearer. And then there, around the same time, there are some other words like quantum plasticity, et cetera, which is really what I'm going to talk about is what I think is going on. So this was then gathering a bit of momentum, but nonetheless, there were some experiments here that people thought were really, couldn't be anything but super solid. This was 2010. And this is the nemesis, by the way. This is John Reppy in the lab, you know, showing apparatus that from an experiment that seemed to show there was not. And just for sociological point of view. He is Moses Chan's PhD supervisor. So. His father is proving him wrong, right? But these two articles, I think, to me, are really important. I mean, these are two news items about the same paper by Moses Chan himself. The original paper was by Kim and Chan, and Sung Kim. There was a paper published in 2012 by Kim and Chan, different Kim, which says that he's saying in the paper that he redid his own experiment by getting rid of things that could create artifacts, and the whole effect went away. And he's very publicly saying he now believes that his interpretation was wrong, that it is not super solid, which is not a common, you know, way for a field to rise and fall, I think, for somebody to generate a whole field of research and then very publicly explain when he did everything to check it that he doesn't believe it anymore. Anyway, so this is a bit of sociology. So So what I want to do in this talk about experiments is I want to introduce superfluidity, because that's what this is analogous to, and in particular the technique that was used to really pin down what's happening in a superfluid, a liquid helium, and how it was applied to look at solid helium and why people thought it was a supersolid, like how this, what these experiments actually were. And then basically what I've mostly been involved in is looking at the elastic properties, and I won't go through this, but this is what we believe is happening. But the reason this is important is because you want to look at this technique and say, do elastic effects come in as well as potential supersolidity? Okay, so just a really, really low-level introduction. Helium's the most quantum liquid or solid. I don't, excluding things like cold atoms, which are low-density gases, and electrons, which aren't themselves, but of real things, like things you could put in a beaker and pour out, right? Water or something. Then helium is the most quantum of those. The reason it's most quantum is that it's a light atom, and has weak forces, so there's nothing to pull it into a crystal and lock it in place. So it actually stays liquid. Unless you pressurize it, helium stays liquid right down to absolute zero, if you could get there. Doesn't freeze. So it's the only thing that remains liquid, you know, at these very low temperatures. Now, if you take a fluid, any fluid, and go to low temperatures, so the atoms are moving slowly, the de Broglie wavelengths are long, and at high densities, then the de Broglie wavelengths interfere and it becomes highly, highly quantum mechanical. And then you say it's a quantum fluid. Anything else just freezes long before that happens with hydrogen or argon or copper or anything else. Now, helium-4, mass 4, is the everyday isotope, the balloon stuff, right? And it's atomic number 2, but it has 2 neutrons. So it has 2 neutrons, 2 protons, 2 electrons. It's a boson. Therefore, it can have things like Bose-Einstein condensation at low temperatures, and it has superfluidity in the real liquid. There is an expensive isotope, which you can buy at much higher price, which is just missing one neutron. It's stable. It's not radioactive. It's rare, but it makes it a fermion. And it has no superfluidity in range at all. You liquefy it. Everything else is chemically identical, same interactions. But it does not become superfluid. Eventually, at 1,000 times lower temperature, 2 helium-3s pair up kind of the way electrons do in a superconductor. And then it has its own superfluid state, which is much more complicated. So that's liquid. And, now, you should point out that just because it's a crystalline solid, and you can pressurize helium and force it to form a crystalline solid, you still have exchange, quantum mechanical exchange, not exchange of electrons, but exchange of actually atoms in a solid. That's possible. There's a tunneling rate. You can have vacancies, and there's nothing that I am aware of that proves that the ground state of a crystal has the same number of atoms as lattice sites. It doesn't have to be so. If that's true, that there are more lattice sites than atoms, that's the equivalent of having some vacancies even in the ground state. And that idea was behind early ideas of supersolidity. But it certainly is a quantum solid. Quantum mechanics is very important even in the crystalline solid at low temperatures. So here's the phase diagram. Temperature from absolute zero up to about 5 Kelvin, pressure up to 80 bar. And what you see is anywhere down here below about 25 bar, even if you go to the lowest temperature, you're in liquid phase. Now, there is a phase transition. This is going from the normal liquid to the superfluid. And there's a phase transition around 2 Kelvin, the lambda transition, where you do that. But if you go to higher pressure, you phase it. You can turn it into a solid. This is a hexagonal crystal structure up here. Okay, so the properties that make a superfluid, this phase down here, at least the most spectacular ones that people are aware of, have to do with flow. I mean, if you... This is one where you, inside a cryostat, you have a little beaker that you hang on a string. You fill it with liquid, superfluid below 2 Kelvin. You pick it up, and it just climbs up as a film without any viscosity, apparently, and drips out and empties itself. It just empties itself. It siphons itself out in 20 seconds or something. I think you can find this as a video on YouTube, actually. It's a classic video. Or you can have what's called a super leak. You imagine making, tamping espresso, right? So you grind something very fine, tamp it down. If you make it too fine, of course, you find you can't make espresso. The water won't go through because it's got viscosity. You can do that. You can make something incredibly fine here. They use something called Jeweler's Rouge, which is extremely fine powder. And you pack it, and it's like glass. To what? Nothing will go through. No liquid will go through it. And if you are up here and you fill the top with liquid, no helium will go through either. This is a normal liquid of viscosity, so nothing happens. But if you cool below this point, at that point, it just falls through that. The liquid just falls through it in as fast, like as if there's nothing there. So it goes through these tiny, tiny holes as if there's no viscosity. In fact, when you do that, you can actually take a little capillary in the shape of a donut, close it, start the liquid circulating. If you do it down here, just go away. Come back a year later. People have done this, 2 years, I think, is the record. And it's still circulating 2 years later, right? Because there's essentially, effectively, no viscosity. So this is why you call it superflow, right? It's flow with apparently no dissipation whatsoever under the right conditions. But there is one catch, and I have to mention this, which is that if you try to force it to flow too fast, it becomes normal. This is very analogous to what happens in a superconductor. There's a critical current. If you try to drive a current through a superconducting wire, it's fine, it's superconducting. Suddenly, at some current, it drives it normal and it has resistance. Same thing is true here. There's a critical velocity for superflow. So if you're down here, it's superfluid, as long as you don't exceed a critical velocity. And the critical velocity depends on the size of the tube and a few things like that. Okay, so that's superfluid. But to really the breakthrough in understanding what a superfluid helium was came in the, 1949 or something, by what was called the Andronicashvili experiment. And what it is it's what's called a torsional oscillator. And it's kind of the gold standard for studying superfluidity. And what you do is you take a mass, you take a stiff rod, and you hang on it a bunch of disks, right? So these disks are a mass that has a moment of inertia, and the rod is a certain torsional twisting stiffness. So this is like a mass on a spring, except instead of going up and down, you twist it, you release it, and it goes, oscillates, right? So the frequency of an oscillator is the stiffness divided by the mass, the moment of inertia, square root, that's the frequency of this oscillator. So this is a way, if you put a rod in there, nothing changes, this would be a way to measure the inertia, moment of inertia of this stack of disks, right? So now what you do is you immerse this stack of disks in liquid. If you did it with water and the disks are close together, all of that water is going to get dragged with them, and the mass of the disks includes that of water. Same is true of normal helium. And so if you do this at above 2 degrees, what you find is that you drag along all the helium between, and you get a moment of inertia that's not just the disks, but it's also the mass of the helium, the inertia of the helium. So the frequency drops as you immerse it, right? If you then go below the superfluid, and some of that superfluid has no viscosity, it's not going to get dragged anymore. So the mass is not all of it, but it's just minus the part that's superfluid, because that part does not get dragged. So you have this picture of the disks oscillating and the liquid not oscillating with it, so it doesn't count in the moment of inertia. So if you do this experiment, which is what Andronicashvili did, is you find that when you immerse it in the normal, sure enough, here's the frequency, it drops, and that's a measure of how much mass there is in the helium. But when you cool below 2 Kelvin, it becomes superfluid, it increases because you get more and more superfluid, and that this measure of between this baseline here is a measure of how much of it's superfluid. It doesn't jump from being all normal to all superfluid. It's a continuous transition. Below about 1 Kelvin, it's 100% superfluid, but it's a continuous transition. And so you're left with this picture that in the superfluid phase, at low temperature, the real liquid helium is composed of a normal and a superfluid component, like two liquids that are mixed. They aren't really two identifiable liquids, but it has two components that behave that way. And the rho s part of it, this part, decouples from the oscillator and increases the frequency of an oscillator. So this is a way to measure rho s, which was missing in those dripping out of beakers kind of experiments.
So,
yep.
So by rho s, do you mean the density, or do you really mean the stiffness?
Density. This is not your winding number, all that kind of stuff. This is the actual equivalent of the fraction of the mass density that is in the superfluid component. I mean, you understand that this is a phenomenological picture, right? But anyway, so this is the picture. So this is what we want to do. And just before I tell you what the experiments were in solid helium, I want to point out what I mean by helium being quantum solid. You put a a lattice here, if this is a classical solid, you don't worry about quantum mechanics. Every atom at zero temperature just sits at precisely at a lattice point determined by the forces with its neighbors, doesn't move. That can't happen with quantum mechanics, because if you put it in there and it doesn't move, the uncertainty principle tells you it must have a big uncertainty in momentum. So if you localize it within one lattice spacing A, then you find it must have an uncertainty in momentum that depends on Planck's constant and how much you do this. And because its mass is light, this is a big deal for helium, right? So if you take the ratio between this quantum zero-point motion that you can't get rid of just because it's in a lattice, and the potential energy just comes from the interatomic forces, typically, you know, in water, that's essentially zero. But even in something like argon, an inert gas, it's only a few percent correction. But in helium, it dominates. In other words, if you make a crystal of helium somehow, most of its energy at zero temperature is not forces with its neighbors. Most of it's just kinetic energy from the uncertainty principle. So quantum mechanics just dominates. So then, given it's quantum mechanical, can it be something like a supersolid? And I'm not going to go through the theoretical arguments of how this would happen. That'd be a different talk. But here's the experiments that I was showing you in the first slide. So this is one where, just by the way, this is in a porous glass. So this is not bulk helium. You make a container, right? You hang it on a torsion rod and do all this stuff. But inside here, you have some very, very porous glass. First thing you can do before you try solid is you can let a little bit of helium and coat the surface with a film of liquid, just all over the surface. And this is what this is. This is the frequency versus temperature. This is a thin film, and this is exactly rho s. And this has been understood for 30 years for films of helium, right? Or 40 years, 30 years anyway. So this is fine. This is a real measurement of the superfluid fraction of a thin film of liquid. You do this. Now you just keep adding, and you fill it with liquid, and you add pressure until finally you freeze it. So now it is all the pores of this material are completely filled with solid helium, crystalline solid. And then you say, what happens? So okay, so just before I do that, this is what I'm saying is frequency. You've noticed I flipped the PowerPoint one over, because half the people in this field that do torsional oscillators plot period, the inverse of frequency, and half plot frequency. So if you're thinking about my frequency, you should invert it. The drop in period is the same as the increase in frequency. Okay, so this is a real superfluid. This is the same system, but when you have solid, it's the analog of this. It freezes up here. This is freezing. Now it comes down. This is 2 Kelvin. It comes down. And at a quite low temperature, about 0.2 Kelvin, the period drops. The frequency goes up. And the interpretation was that the logical explanation of that is you're oscillating it, and it's because there's less moment of inertia here, which means some of the helium is not moving with the oscillator. It must be superfluid. That's the interpretation. And there's one more thing, which is you can oscillate slowly or fast, hard. And if you oscillate hard, meaning the oscillator itself is moving faster, the effect goes away. And this would be the analog of this critical velocity effect. You're exceeding a critical velocity. If you go too fast, the motion, it isn't super fluid, super solid anymore. So these two features of a period drop or frequency increase and a apparent critical velocity, which is fairly low, were the essential evidence for super solidity. But this was in this complicated glass. So what they did then was the same thing, but instead of the glass, they just filled the entire thing with a crystal of helium, the logical thing. And they saw the same thing. Period, this is the amplitude of oscillation. If I flip them over, frequency at the same temperature, decoupling, same dependence on velocity, and there's a dissipation peak. If the amplitude is small, the dissipation is high, right at this crossover. Yes?
This is a question. I'm not an expert in this area, but I assume they checked that there wasn't any heat transfer from the oscillator, so that some of this stuff melted.
Yeah, people ask exactly those. And even worse than worrying about heat transfer, when you have a crystal of helium, the solid doesn't wet the walls, and you know you've got a little tiny layer of liquid between the crystal and the walls, unless you go to quite high pressure. So people immediately started worrying, is there a liquid layer that makes it slip? I mean, it was pretty easy to convince himself it wasn't heating. And it wasn't. In fact, John Reppe, the first oscillator to confirm these experiments was John Reppe at Cornell. He deliberately built a torsional oscillator that was in the shape of a cube so that it couldn't slip, and saw the same effect, okay? So people suspected that, but they sorted that out pretty early on. Okay, so here it is, and so these are the two things that suggest the supersolid: the fact that the frequency increases from decoupling, apparently, and it goes away above a critical velocity. These two other features I should point out is the dissipation peak that goes along with it is always there, and it's not a very sharp transition, and those two things are not the same as a superfluid liquid, so they're a little puzzling, and it's not clear that what they're telling you. Okay, they did one other experiment, which was very clever, they thought, and it was, but which was it, this was an annulus. In other words, they didn't have an open cylinder. They had a little cylindrical channel here. They then took the cell apart or built another one and slipped a little block in there and put it all back together, and all of this went away. So the idea was that you've got superflow around an annulus of a couple centimeters, and you put a little piece in there, block it, it's gone. It's got to be flow. That's the argument, right? Okay, and then within, well, you know, half a dozen years, experimental groups all over the world did this. So by this point, there's at least 10 other labs around the world where they'd seen essentially the same thing, right, in torsional oscillators. They include, you know, two other ones at Cornell, or two at Cornell, Japan, Korea, UK, France, everywhere. So the phase diagram always agreed. This is from Moses Chan, but below about 200 Kelvin and pretty much independent of pressure. So this is the solidification. You can apply higher pressure. You go through this transition. So the idea is this is super solid below about 0.2 Kelvin. Everything looks the same almost, with about one exception, which is some experiments showed that 1 or 2% of the solid decoupled, not 100%. It's not like liquid where it's 100%. So they would say, oh, the superfluid fraction, even at zero temperatures, 2%, maybe as high as 5%. I think the record was 16%, but not all of it. But the record was 16%, but there's other ones that saw everything looked the same, except it was only 0.015%. There's a factor of whatever that is, 1, 2, 3, 1,000, between how much of it seems to go superfluid. So this is very strange, right? You see all the same phenomena, but a factor of 1,000 different in magnitude. Okay, so this was the state, I don't know, after about 5 or 6 years. But one of the things that started to worry people, including me, was the torsional oscillator and the formula I gave you all had to do with a liquid. There is a difference with a solid, right? So the picture is, here's the experiment, here's the oscillator, solid helium inside, solid, they fill it typically through a hole in the torsion rod, typically. And so there's solid there. And so you say, okay, well, the assumption in interpreting this as super solid is that you're losing some mass because it becomes super solid. It might be 0.15% or 2% or something, but there's some amount, and that all makes sense. But there is an issue. This is solid, and solids have elastic effects that liquids don't. So you can't directly take stuff for a liquid and say this is exactly the same. In particular, if you fill the rod, and that rod is solid, then that rod is going to contribute to the frequency. Because you see, it's not just the inertia. Now, if this thing changes because the helium freezes or changes, it is going to affect the period. So an increase in the stiffness of the rod due to the helium, it looks exactly like a decrease in the mass due to decoupling of superfluid. That's the really tricky part here. Now, people would say, oh, that effect is tiny, right? It can't be the answer. Okay, so we started to worry a lot about that. And in particular, okay, fine, you know, there'd be no reason to worry about it. Like, why would it look like this, is the question. Okay, fine, there's a little elastic effect, but why on earth would it change at 0.2 Kelvin and do all this stuff? The problem is it does. So when we first did elastic measurements in 2007, we did a completely different technique. It's not torsional oscillator at all. We directly measured the shear modulus of the thing, and it looks almost the same. That's the really disconcerting part now, right? So what this is the torsional oscillator frequency, basically, just plotted as a function of temperature. This red and this orange are just two different crystals. We measured the shear modulus at 2 kilohertz. So they look basically the same from two crystals. We actually measured it at some different frequencies, and it shifts a little bit. But if you take something comparable, like this is measured 1,000, this is measured a few hundred, if you take this curve and just plot them, they really kind of look a lot alike. Right? And this is elastic. This has nothing to do with inertia. So in fact, if you shift one up, you just scale them so the same. Just to see the temperature depends, they look a lot alike. Right? So this is really disconcerting now, that you have an elastic effect, has the same behavior. Maybe that's what's really going on. Okay, so the argument was then, no, they're way too small. People started calculating with numerical modeling of their system or estimating on the back of the envelope or something. They said, no, these elastic effects are negligible and they're very small, right? So there's various ways that elastic effects can enter a torsional oscillator measurement. So this is a typical one, like Moses Chan's first one, where there's a hole. So clearly there's going to be an elastic effect here. It doesn't have to be there. You can make the hole small, for example. The second one with this annulus, it could be that as you think of jello in an oscillator. You start oscillating it, it's not a liquid, it's a solid, but it's a very floppy solid, and so as you oscillate it, it kind of overshoots and back and forth, and if it becomes stiffer somehow, that overshoot will change. There will be an effect due to flopping around in there. Some of them have something in the middle, a metal piece that's kind of floppy, in which case this little area here is essentially solid helium acting as a glue. It's gluing the inside and the outside and making the whole thing more rigid. Anytime you make an oscillator more rigid, its period will go down, its frequency will go up, it looks like it's decoupling. And in the ones with the Vicor, there's a little area here. Again, it'll act like a glue and do all those kind of things. So you have to worry about all kinds of different places it could enter. Not all oscillators are designed the same. So this one, for example, is the one we focused on. So this was the year before last when I was on sabbatical. I was just sitting at the desk talking to Sebastian, and we said, well, surely people have all worried about this particular contribution, because Moses Chan, I knew, had, and designed their oscillator so it's negligible. So then we looked at all 10 people's oscillators and said, well, first of all, it's easy to estimate. You know, this is just a classical, you know, undergraduate elasticity question. The contribution to the frequency change of whatever's in here, it depends on the shear modulus of whatever's in here, because you're twisting it, compared to the shear modulus of the out part, the metal part, that you think of as the torsion rod. So that's this ratio. And it depends on how tiny the hole is. If it's a tiny hole, it has essentially no effect. It goes to the fourth power. And so you say, okay, well, first of all, this ratio, helium is 5,000 or 2,000 times softer than metal. It's a very weak thing. So, okay, that's already tiny, just this part alone. Typically, this ratio could be 10 in some oscillators. So you get 10 to the fourth. You know, when you multiply them together, you get something like 10 to the minus 10. You can never measure anything that small. That's clearly not important. But in other people's oscillators, this is more like 0.8 or 1.2 or something, right? And you do that and you say, okay, well, it could be 10 to the minus 4. So it's very small. But then you say, okay, actually look at the actual frequency changes they measure. They're like this magnitude too. So we just took all the oscillator designs and calculated how much the elastic effect could be. And so what we've got here is on this axis is this ratio of how big the hole in the rod is compared to the rod to decide whether it's a big or a small effect. It predicts, if you take them, it predicts a maximum possible elastic effect due to the helium, and you compare it to what they actually measure. This red line is that calculation. So if you're to the left or below this, all of your measured effect could be elastic, right? And it's disconcerting that out of 10, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 or 6 of them, the majority of them are already in the regime where known elastic effects could cause the whole effect that's observed. There's some outliers, Moses Chan, the student Nsung Kim, John Reppy, but then this isn't the only place elastic effects can come in. So one of the other places is elastic overshoot. So this is what I mean by that. If you imagine looking down and this and oscillates and you have your floppy jello blue helium there, as you oscillate it overshoots, right? And so that's clearly changing your apparent moment of inertia. This other place where you have glue, I won't explain it, but basically in these cases there is a difference. You can distinguish it from an inertia effect because it doesn't have the same frequency dependence. It's not just a stiffening. This is something else. So in these two cases, if you measure the frequency dependence, you could distinguish inertia from whatever's going on. And the catch is that normally nobody can make a torsional oscillator work at more than one frequency, so you couldn't do that. So several groups cleverly built oscillators that could be run in two different modes at high and low frequency. And lo and behold, what they tended to find was that the effect is not independent of frequency. It is not inertia. It is frequency dependent. It's either this decoupling or this kind of glue effect in the oscillator. It really is not inertial. It's elastic in origin. That wipes out two more of those groups' data points because they know that that's what's going on. So you're down to like 1 or 2 points of all the 10 oscillators. So this, I think, is the last piece of this, and this is where Moses Chan went public with saying that it really isn't. Which is that the original experiment was the Vicor, and they had a little gap. And your intuition says that you should minimize how much bulk solid helium is around, because that's spurious. You're trying to figure out what's going on inside the pores. So they make this gap as small as possible. They fit everything tightly together. But if you think about gluing furniture together or anything you want to glue together, if you want a strong bond, you use a thin layer of glue. A thick layer of glue is pretty soft. So the thinner you make this, the worse the problem gets, not the better, if it's a sort of a glue effect in the solid. So they went to great effort to minimize this, making everything worse, actually. And so what Moses did finally in 2012 is he rebuilt this experiment, redid it all over again, but he didn't put a metal cap and have a gap. He coated it with epoxy, so there really is no gap. He coated everything perfectly. And when you do that, what he saw was this is the original data with a gap. There's nothing left. There's no signal that there would be decoupling. And so this is the point at which he said, okay, I now accept I don't believe that there is a super solid in any of my experiments, right? Unfortunately, his student, the original In Sung Kim, has an independent lab in Korea and is doing other really interesting experiments and is completely convinced that there is super solid. So, for other reasons. However, so this was kind of, I think, the end for 90% of the people in the field. This was where people would say, okay, not that there isn't a super solid in principle, not that there might even be one in reality, but that these experiments aren't finding it, that the torsional oscillator. That would be, I think, the current state for almost everybody. I can name a few exceptions, but that would really be the 90% level, including me. And so this was the shot down by its own discovery news story. Okay, so now moving on from that, I want to talk about my own kind of work, which was the elastic part, right? And where we've moved on from that. Because we think we understand what's going on in the elasticity, but it becomes in itself a very interesting problem, or what's going on in a quantum solid if it isn't supersolidity, okay? So the experiment we did is incredibly simple conceptually, and actually turned out to be incredibly simple experimentally, although I shouldn't say that. Which is you just want to measure a shear modulus. A shear modulus is you deform a solid, not compressing it, but shearing it and measure the stress, or apply a stress and measure the deformation. And nobody does it that way. They propagate sound waves and do stuff like this, but you can do it that way. So we put two transducers. These are shear transducers that you put a voltage on and they shear. You bolt them in place or glue them in place with a little gap between them, and you grow solid helium all around and in between them. You apply a voltage to this one and it deforms. That causes a shear deformation. I've tried to sketch these things here to show what's going on. The deformation applies a stress, a force on the other one, and when you apply a force to a piezoelectric, it gives you a charge and you measure it. So applying a voltage gives you a deformation, a shear deformation. Measuring it gives you the stress. The ratio of stress to strain is just the current you get out of this thing divided by the voltage. It's current over frequency because that's charge. So it's just the charge over the voltage, and that's what you measure, and it works beautifully after a couple of mistakes. At the same time, you can measure dissipation because there's always a phase lag if you have any dissipation in the system. So you measure the phase between the voltage you apply and this one. Now, the nice thing about this turns out that it's not like a torsional oscillator that works at one frequency only. You just turn the knob. If you want to do it at 0.2 hertz, you do. If you want to do it at 20 kilohertz, you do. You do it any frequency you want. It's just a little noisier at low frequency. So you can just tune the frequency, do everything as a function of frequency over whatever that is, five orders of magnitude in frequency. You can do this. This is gentle because, you know, the torsional oscillator is a very gentle probe, particularly since they have to keep it oscillating more slowly than this critical velocity. So it's very, very gentle, and they would go on and on about this, but it's not as gentle as you can do this. You can do this at strains of tenth, like the fractional strain, like how much it moves compared to the distance, the width of the thing, can be as low. You can do a sensible measurement at 10 to the minus 10. So I was trying to think what this is. So if you take, I'm from Edmonton, if you take, you know, the Quebec border and the BC border, and you shift one up by, say, half a millimeter, that's a strain, a shear strain of 10 to the minus 10. Maybe it's less than half a millimeter. It's a fraction of a millimeter, a few hundred microns. So it's fairly gentle, right? And you can go higher. You can just turn the voltage up. It's no problem. The stresses corresponding to this are really tiny. Like the weight of the helium sitting on itself is orders of magnitude bigger than this. So it's a very, very gentle probe, if you want it to be. Okay, so this was what I showed you before. This was the torsional oscillator. This was the shear modulus, looked the same. And just this is just pointing out that there was this dissipation peak. There was also a dissipation peak, which we measure. It looks the same. They really are very similar, so that's fine. They saw this amplitude dependence, right? So we looked, right? It's very gentle, but it doesn't have to be. You just turn up the voltage. Now, they said that it's when you exceed a critical speed of oscillation. But if you only got one frequency, it might not be critical speed. It might be critical amplitude or critical acceleration or anything. It's just the harder you do it, something happens. So because we can vary frequency, we can distinguish. But the first thing to realize is that if you do exactly the same thing and start turning up the amplitude, it does exactly the same thing. This amplitude dependence is there. But we can be sure that it is actually not a critical velocity effect. The frequency dependence tells us for sure that what happens is you have the shear modulus. If you exceed a critical strain or a critical stress in the crystal, then it goes away, not a critical velocity. Because you can just go to really high frequency and very small stress, it's still there. You know, and that's a high velocity, but that doesn't make it go away. It's the stress or strain that makes it go away. Okay, the helium-3 effect I didn't mention before, but there's a dramatic helium-3 effect. Helium-4, it comes out of the bottle in your balloon. It's less than one part per million isotopic helium-3. It's about 0.2 or 0.3 parts per million. incredible isotopic purity. You cool helium-3 down, every other impurity, hydrogen, air, oil, everything freezes on the walls. It's not in the crystal. So you can be quite sure, if you're a little bit careful, that the only impurities in the crystal are helium-3 impurities and helium-4, and there's only a fraction of a part per million of them. You'd think that would be negligible, right? Who would think that that would be a big deal? But you can buy, and actually, sorry, wrong, you can't buy, you used to be able 20 years ago or 30 years ago to buy helium purified, isotopically purified from the US. Well, 30 years ago they quit doing it. But if you do that, and I had a bottle sitting around, you find that the regular old stuff has this transition around stiffening below about 200 millikelvin. If you go down to one part per billion of helium-3 in this isotope, it shifts all the way down to about 75 millikelvin. So you, chemically, this is the same, right? I mean, this is like water. I think seawater is whatever it is, 100 parts per million, heavy water, deuterated water, something like that. This is like saying that you take water, which freezes at 270 kelvin, not 270 millikelvin, and you remove the heavy water component, and suddenly it stays liquid down to liquid nitrogen temperature at 77 kelvin. I mean, it's a dramatic effect, even though the temperature scale is in the lower one. So clearly it's incredibly sensitive, and we did this with, you know, several impurities. These, by the way, are the torsional oscillator data scaled at the same purities, these two. You see that the same thing, this is the same thing that was happening in the torsional oscillator, no question, right? So, okay, so it does everything. This is the problem. The elastic properties, first of all, they're big enough in most cases to explain or mostly explain the torsional oscillator. And secondly, they have exactly the same temperature, amplitude, helium-3, and more frequency dependence, everything we could think of. So that's why I think people are pretty convinced now that this is the origin, and this is what we're studying, so we keep studying. What it is, the next question of what we're looking at, what actually is going on, we have to, and that, there's some clues, lots of clues in that already. But other clues are, I can grow a crystal, by the way, the freezing point is 2 Kelvin. So you start up here, it's solid, the black one here is growing, nothing happens, it just stays constant shear modulus. Below, this is a pure isotopically pure crystal, so below 100 millikelvin, it goes up by 10% or something. If we warm it right back up to just a little bit below melting, the way you anneal a metal, heat it up and wait. You do that, it does change. So after doing that, you cool it down, it just comes down here, but it's shifted and just stays shifted, just parallel, goes back up. But the interesting thing here I want to point out is that the high temperature behavior was changed by annealing. In the end, when you get to low temperatures, right back. So this is the intrinsic behavior. This is the part that we should worry about. This is the part that depends on the crystal quality and stuff. And you can do more. You can go down to low temperature here. You can apply a big stress, just, you know, mess up your crystal. Apparently, nothing happens. But as soon as you warm it up, you realize, yeah, something did happen. It just isn't noticeable here. But when you go up to higher temperature, it's a big difference. You can anneal it. You can do it over and over. So in every case, if you plastically deform it or anneal it, the low temperature behavior is unchanged. It seems to be the intrinsic behavior, right? And it's the high temperature behavior we should be trying to understand. This is the reverse of what you're trying to do if you think it's super fluid, super solid, is you think you got a regular old crystal at high temperature, it becomes super fluid below 200 millikelvin, so maybe how much becomes super fluid, maybe that depends on how the crystal quality or something, but that would lead you to say this is constant and that changes. So the Nemesis, by the way, John Reppe did just that. He managed to build a torsional oscillator where he could plastically deform it. And it's the same. The behavior at low temperature is intrinsic, but plastic deformation affects the high temperature behavior. It's not going from a universal normal crystal to some super solid with different amounts of super solid. It's going from something that's the same and the high temperature, it's variable, depending on crystal quality. Okay. So now, if you just take these things, the changes in modulus are large. I'll show you later. Not just, those were 5 or 10%, the ones I showed you, which is already huge. But we've seen more recently, you know, almost complete disappearance of the shear modulus. It changes by almost 90%. Huge. It varies. You know, sometimes it's 5%, and in a high-quality crystal, it's higher. It depends on impurities at very low levels. It depends. These all tell you that this is not a property of pure, perfect, defect-free helium. It's something to do with defects. And this one alone, to a metallurgist, says there's nothing like vacancies or impurities that by themselves can create significant changes in sound speeds or modulus. It has to be a particular defect dislocations. They're the ones that give you softened plastic and softened elastic properties. So it's there. Now, if you don't know, I'll just give you a 2-minute primer on dislocations and show you what they are. So crystals have dislocations. You can hardly grow a crystal without a screw dislocation to let it grow. So that's the growth surface. If you deform something, you punch a hole or punch a dent in something and look at it in a microscope, you see all these lines. These are dislocations. Even in helium, we know they're there. People in the 90s went to a synchrotron, grew the best single crystals they could grow, looked at imaging in X-ray, and you see bands of them. You couldn't resolve individual ones, but they're bands sort of lined up. These are bands that must be groups of dislocations. What they are, so there's two kinds. The one that grow is this kind of one, the line is up and down, and it spirals as it grows up around that. But one that mostly I'll talk about is what, this is called a screw dislocation. An edge dislocation, just take a lattice, cut a slice halfway through and insert a half plane of atoms. So up here it's perfect, down here it's perfect, but there's a distorted region. The line going into the screen is the dislocation line. It's a one-dimensional thing. And it's the edge of an extra half plane. That's an edge dislocation. Now they can move sideways, it turns out, because in order to move sideways, you don't have to move mass around. You just hop, just move things past each other.
So isn't there a sliver of BCC phase just below the melting transition?
There's one right on the melting transition, but it's only at higher temperatures. I mean, you can go through it, but it covers a little very, very narrow rate region of pressure, temperature, phase space from about 1.4 to 1.8 Kelvin. So as long as anything's below 1.4 Kelvin, you must be in the HCP phase. Technically, you can either hit it or avoid it. It's like if you're careful, you can go to high pressure and go off above it, so you never hit the BCC phase. If you're careful, you can go past it and then come from the liquid into the HCP again. So you can avoid it either at low pressure or high pressure, or if you want to see what happens, you can go right through it and have a big crystal phase transition to mess everything up. So you can do any of those that you want. But if you have them, they're lines, they tend to run into each other. When they run into each other, they tend to make a network and they pin each other really pretty effectively. So if you anneal a metal and look at it in a microscope, you tend to see this semi-regular network of these things coming to their lowest energy state. So that's one thing. They form a network, and we'll talk a bit about that. The other thing is, say these are the network nodes. So these points can't move. In between, it can move sideways. But if you put in impurities, you tend to immobilize it. If they stick on it, they can't move, right? So this is, for example, why carbon steel is hard, right? If you get a nice, pure iron, it's relatively soft. You put in some carbon, the carbon clusters and pins all the dislocations, and they can't move. So you make something hard, or in our case, make the shear modulus high. If we can put in some pinning, the only thing we have available in helium is helium-3. So we put in, that we think is the effect of these impurities, is even a small number of them can immobilize the dislocations and have a big effect. But they're not very tightly bound onto these things, especially if it's helium and just helium-3. You pull hard, apply a big stress, they're going to rip away. When it rips away, it'll be soft again. And if you deform, you create them. This is what's called a Frank Reed source. It's the way they do it. You deform, and they form loops, and you get these kind of artistic TEM pictures of the loops left behind. But you can deform and create them. You can anneal and remove, not all of them, but a lot of them, and you can change things that way. So the next question before I show you our latest experiments is how does the presence of dislocations affect the shear modulus, say, the elastic properties? And it does have a big effect. So here's this little animation. Here's this red line is this extra half plane. But you can see if you're pushing back and forth on the top and the bottom, one way for the thing to deform is just to have local rearrangements, which you can think of as moving the location of this half plane, this edge dislocation. So edge dislocation moves sideways. That's called glide because it's conservative. There's no atoms have to come and go. They just hop over each other. And the result is that you take a crystal and you push it one way, you shear it. So it allows a crystal to deform without having to actually overcome atomic bonds, meaning it's going to be softer. It's going to be elastically softer. Okay. Now, how much it does depends on how long these dislocations are between points they're pinned. And so if the average distance between points where they can't move is pinned, you apply a stress, it tends to pull it to one side. Apply a stress, it's pushing this thing. How far it moves and how big, how much deformation you get depends on how long they are and how far they move. So it turns out, if you just do a little bit of algebra, that you end up saying that the amount it deforms is proportional. Lambda is just the density. Like you can have, if you take a square piece and look how many puncture it, you can say you have 10 per square centimeter puncturing it, or 1,000 or 100,000 or whatever. So it's the density, it's how high quality. And the other is the length, how far are they between these pinning points. But it goes like this, it goes like the density times L squared. And so does the change in the shear modulus. The decrease due to them goes like this. And there's some numbers that just have to do with some other parameters, like the orientation of the crystal and a few things like that, that are of order one. But it's this combination that determines it, the density times L squared, which is an interesting combination because it's a geometric parameter, not a measure of the quality of the crystal necessarily. If you take something really simple, like a nice cubic lattice of dislocations, and say, here's the length between them, it's the same for every one, you can figure out how many of these things you have per square centimeter and how what the total length is. This quantity is dimensionless. This is the number per square centimeter times centimeter squared or meters, whatever you like. It's just 3 for this lattice. If you get a cubic lattice, it's 3. If you got a different shape of lattice, it's something else. And if you throw that in, you can say, well, you can get changes, knowing the magnitude of these other numbers, of order 30% drop in the shear modulus if you had a cubic lattice of dislocations. That's enormous. There's nothing else like vacancies or impurities that can give you anything even in that order of magnitude or even two orders of magnitude less. So you can get very large changes from dislocations as long as they can move. But if you pin them, so here's my lattice and I imagine having the helium-3 pinning them, well, what that does is they're now the distance they can move is very small. And so this L squared that goes into it becomes very small. Basically, if you pin them even a moderate amount, putting 5 pinning points here, the goes from 30% to like 0.1%. It just goes away. They become stiff again. So pinning by helium-3 will make it stiff. We know, either from calculations or other experiments, that helium-3 do exactly this. They bind onto any dislocation they can get, and they have a binding energy of a bit less than a Kelvin. So when you go below a Kelvin, they're going to go and they're going to sit on those dislocations and keep it from moving, right? So the temperature dependence that we see is here's high temperature. You know, they're bound, but you're at 2 degrees, so hardly any of them are on here. It kind of moves. You go to low enough temperature, way below this, they're all going to go sit on there, and this thing's not going anywhere. So this is a stiff state at low temperature. That's the origin of the fact it stiffens. But this is the intrinsic one, because now the dislocations aren't doing any softening. What's really you're measuring is the intrinsic stiffness of the crystal with no softening due to the dislocation.
So if I think about pinning impurities in a superconductor, right, then I can see why a pin defects, because I modify the potential, chemical potential to the host, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay, this is a really good question. And it's what we spent a lot of time in the last year. Can I show you at the end? Why? I mean, this is the question of, this is a picture metallurgists have all the time. Because they say, okay, carbon is not mobile in steel at room temperature, right? It is at high temperature. And people happily said this is what helium-3, but it's not obvious that helium-3 just doesn't move along with it if you stress it. It can move. It's just moving in a similar lattice. But there are some there are reasons that this think this may not happen in certain regimes because of quantum statistics, actually. So just before I get to the new experiments, so this also explains the dependence on the concentration of impurities. Because if you're going to go down to low temperature and you start with this 300 parts per million, but instead of that, you go to this really, really high purity, 1 part per million. If you're at the same temperature, you get the same probability that any one atom is bound, but here you got 300 times more. And the pinning is 300 times less at the same temperature. There's 300 times fewer helium-3s. So at the same temperature, this one's going to be soft while this one is stiff. And if you go, in other words, you have to go to a much lower temperature if the helium-3 concentration in order to get to this state. So to explain, and you can do this quantitatively. You can say, okay, it makes sense. Makes sense as long as this binding energy is about 0.7 Kelvin, which is what a calculation would tell you. Okay, so this is just a summary of all that, right? If you have dislocations and they're mobile, it softens it by quite a lot. Impurities seem to bind to, they do bind to them, and that causes stiffening when you go below some temperature of order 200 millikelvin or lower temperature of high purity. If you go high, they unbind, so it's soft at high temperature. So the low temperature part is the intrinsic because the dislocations aren't moving. They're unbound and move at high temperature. If you pull hard on this thing, the amplitude dependence is just simply that you exceed a stress and you rip away the dislocation from the helium-3s. At least that's what we thought was happening. That makes sense, too. You can estimate that force, and it's not that big.
Mm-hmm. So the quantumness comes from the ability to form the good dislocation network.
It's not clear in anything I've said to you where the quantum mechanics of the quantum solid are coming in. It's coming in practically and technically that you could never do a lot of experiments without it because you could never get equilibrium between the dislocations and the impurities at low temperature. I mean, you can't do that. They don't move. Classical impurity does not move at low temperature. It can't get to equilibrium. Helium-3 one can. A helium-3 impurity in helium-4 is a delocalized quasi-particle at zero temperature. So that's one thing. That's a technically it allows you to measure these things. Still not clear where the quantumness is coming into the dislocation motion, but maybe I'll show you where it may come in, which is that a classical dislocation is also localized at low temperature and low stress. It's sitting in a well. It can't go anywhere, whereas this one seems to go very easily, no matter how gently you push it. Okay, so this is the stuff that, in particular, I did it in the last couple of years, starting in Paris, which is great. So if you're a material scientist and you want to figure out really in detail now how you understand this, they would say, for goodness sake, you know, grow good samples, characterize your samples. You know, because everything I should say, by the way, everything in the torsional oscillator, everything we did was in crappy polycrystalline messes that we just grew. And people thought that was a good idea because they thought that supersolidity was associated with defects. So they deliberately tried to make lousy crystals. It was a nice rationalization because it's very hard to make good crystals. So here's the experiment. And the inside part here is the two transducers mounted on some blocks. This is the part I brought, or I brought the pieces to Paris. The outside part is the cell, which you'll notice is an optical cell. You can see through it. Right? So you can actually see what you're growing. And so, I don't know, can you see these at all in the light? I don't know how we're doing here, but if you can see them, these are little videos that the student took when we were growing crystals. So these are the bottom piece of this cell. This is just looking down here. You see a little piece here. This is a solid. Here's another one where the crystal grew in the side. I hope you can see some of it. And here's one where the crystal's sitting here waiting. And so if I look at the crystal growth, on this, something like this, you can't tell very much that it's a crystal, right? but if you, because it's rough, smooth. But if I grow it and melt it, when during growth facets show up, right, for various reasons. And can you see the hexagonal crystal? As you melt it, they go away, but you can see it. And you can see here nice, much nicer, hopefully, crystal facets. By analyzing these pictures, you can definitely tell the exact orientation of the crystal. And it's pretty convincing they're single crystals because they just grow and fill the whole cell. Here's one where we're slowly growing it. So you would do this. You want to get different orientations. And the way you do it is the student just tries and tries and tries until they photograph something they like, and then they try to keep it and not accidentally melt it. And then you've got it. And the nice thing is you can melt it right down to nothing and then grow it fast. So you can study a crystal with precisely the same orientation, grown fast, grown slow, different qualities, but it is the same seed crystal, right? So you can do that.
This is something that you can't do with classical crystals.
No, you can't. I mean, it's almost impossible. And, you know, like you can't get equilibrium between the crystal roughening, faceting. That's just a slow process with thermal processes, latent heat and stuff. There's no latent heat in helium at low temperature. These are grown, by the way, at 20 millikelvin where there's no latent heat. This is a mechanical process. You can grow these crystals. Like this is a cell of, you know, this size. I mean, it's 10, 15 cubic centimeters. You can grow that crystal in a second as a nice single crystal. Wham, it's done. Right? You just push gas in and it's done. And it's at 25 millikelvin, you got a single crystal of 10 cubic centimeters and everything. So you can grow, and you can do this over and over. I mean, you know, the student would grow. You'd come in the morning, frankly. He did it at night. You'd come in and say he's got a nice crystal, and you say how many tries, and he says 40. You know, he grew 40 crystals to get the one he wanted. So this is, by the way, this is Mark II. One of the things I'll point out is the transducers stick up here. It's just easier to solder wires on things that stick up. Really bad idea. So I rebuilt ones made so same idea, but the transducers don't stick up. Most the measurements I'll show you are from this cell. Same idea. Here's pictures. So the idea was you grew a crystal and you measure the apparent shear modulus. And of course, when there's liquid between them, there's no shear modulus. Right? So when the crystal is in the cell below here, below them, nothing happens. As soon as this crystal starts to creep up into the gap, so you've got solid, you start to see something. Here's the interface. Here's the interface above it. So by the point where the crystal emerges from the top, now you're done. You finish growing this volume of liquid. Nothing else changes. So when you have liquid converted into solid between, you start to see a shear modulus, and that's what you measure. But these are single crystals with a very precisely known orientation. And you can grow them very slowly and gently in the hopes of getting very high quality crystals. You can't see it, but in hopes that the defects are very few. And here's just some pictures of some of the examples that the student used to actually find the orientation. So you have a crystal, you know, you have a lab frame of, you know, up this direction, that direction, and you have the crystal axis frame. It's hexagonal, so you have a C-axis. The elastic properties only depend on the direction of the C-axis. So you have this. So now you fit these pictures and find the orientation. Then you do just a little bit of tensor algebra, right? Because the elasticity is a, okay, the shear stress and strain are second rank tensors. The elasticity is a fourth rank tensor. You have to do all your mathematical rotations from the frame with the c-axis where you know the elastic constants. There's five independent elastic constants in a hexagonal crystal, but this is the form they take if your z-axis is aligned with the c-axis. But it isn't in, you know, like in ours. So you have to do this rotation. You get a slightly complicated expression that depends on, you know, the angle from vertical and the angle from horizontal from the plates, right? But anyway, you do it. It's not that difficult. These coefficients, by the way, have been measured 30 years, 40 years ago in different kind of experiment. They're known for helium. And so when you do this kind of measurements I described, of measuring the shear modulus as a function of temperature, here's a whole bunch of different crystals grown, all single crystals, beautifully oriented. And you see some things. First of all, that even at low temperature, so this should be the intrinsic crystal one, they have different stiffness. Well, that's actually expected because depending on what orientation you're in, you're either probing C44 or C66 or something else. So the actual elastic constant you're measuring depends on the orientation of the crystal, and those are different. So it's no surprise that these are different numbers. But what's really maybe a bit surprising is that in some crystals, it decreases by 60% as you go to half a degree. In other crystals, it doesn't seem to be anything at all, right? So then you look at which crystals you're dealing with. And you're dealing with this particular crystal for here, the one that doesn't change, and the maximum one here. So you plug into this formula and say, with those known orientations, how big do you affect? This is what you find. For this orientation, it's essentially independent of what you think of as the usual shear modulus. The C44 is the elastic constant that you think of as the shear modulus. It doesn't come into this. It's just a particular orientation where that's not what you're measuring. This one is essentially 100%, 93% C44. So this tells you that the elastic constant of all of them that's changing is just one of the five. The others aren't doing a thing. It's just one of the two shear constants, C44 and C66. So now you know what's changing, C44. And in fact, you can take all of this data. First of all, you can throw in the known constants and say, okay, do these agree? These ticks on here, by the way, are the calculated zero ones for those orientations, and they, at low temperature, they all go to them. So that really is the intrinsic behavior of solid helium. This is the softening. So you can convert all of these with the assumption that it's only C44 changing, take out all the elastic constants, accept that, and change it. That's what you get. I mean, within some scatter, these are different crystals, the C44 changes by 55 to 60%. Drops by that. This is a very big effect, but it's all in C44, and it's very consistent. What does that mean? Well, I mean, we call this giant because there's nothing else has. I mean, it's very unusual to find a 1% shear modulus change due to dislocations in a metal or something conventional. You don't see 50 or 60%. So it's a huge effect because somehow these dislocations are very mobile in helium. And the fact that only C44 changes, I mean, it's not quite obvious, but really what that C44 is, if you take a stack of planes with your C-axis this way, they slide over each other like graphite, that's C44, that's that elastic constant. That's telling you that that's the plane, the basal plane, that dislocations are gliding in. So it tells you which dislocations are moving in what direction. It's edge dislocations moving in freely in the basal plane of and affecting only C44. So now we're very confident that that's exactly what the dislocations are doing. Okay, this is just showing as a function of stress. If you stress it, this is the stress. Here's ones that are stiff, and you because they've got helium-3 in them, and you this is all done at very low temperatures. They're in this stiff state. You at some point it softens because you've broken away with stress. All the dislocations just rip away from the helium-3s. Was our picture, and the interesting thing is there is a trick where we believe that you can grow a helium-4 crystal with no helium-3, not one part per billion, but none, like no one atom in there. We actually suspect that there's not one atom of helium-3. It's kind of a thermodynamic trick, but when you do that trick and measure the shear modulus, it's soft. I mean, this is where it should be if it was a crystal without dislocations. It's something like 86% lower, or 80% lower, right down to the lowest stresses we can apply. This is the lowest temperature we can reach. This is the lowest stress we can apply, and it's soft. They move under those conditions. Freely, enormously. So this seems to be this barrier that you think of in conventional things. It does take this little barrier to hop a dislocation from site to site. Seems to be zero in helium. It's so unmeasurably small in what we think are pretty good experiments. Okay, so this is, I'll just go through this very quick. Once you understand this, which we really understood about a year ago, then you can say, okay, now that we know this, we can really start to try to understand how many dislocations we have, how they form a network, how they move, all kinds of things. But it's a little tricky to do that. So this is a typical crystal where at these temperatures, it's very, very soft. There's a little bit of helium-3, so if you go to lower temperature, it'll stiffen because the helium-3 is binding. But this region is giant plasticity. If you go to higher temperature, something else happens. These dislocations are moving fairly fast through a crystal that has a lot of thermal phonons at high temperature. The thermal phonons scatter off and damp them. I mean, there's no question about that. That's well known in metals too. But we can see it. So you see that they start to become immobilized at high temperature because phonons are stopping them from moving. They're like a soup of phonons. And you can figure this out. I don't know if I'll go through this. But if you look at this, there's a way from this. You get this very large modulus change. This is telling you, by the way, that this, what I said was this geometric parameter, one that was 3 for a cubic lattice, is about 50 or bigger. Just because we see such a big change, it must be large. 50 is a very weird thing. It's saying you'd have a whole bunch of dislocations and they take great care not to intersect each other. Because if they intersect each other, they'd pin and you get a number like 3. But they must be aligned in some way that they don't really intersect very often. And I think it's those boundaries I showed you in the X-ray topograph. It's probably what they do. They go into sort of layers and stay away from each other. So that's these things. I think it's reasonable given what people know about dislocations in helium. But what we'd like to do, and they couldn't do in X-ray things, is actually figure out how many dislocations you've got, right? And so there's nothing we can do with this data alone that'll do that, because all you ever get out is this combination lambda L squared. But the dissipation that I haven't talked much about does have a clue, because if you have a dislocation that's moving fast and it's being damped by phonons, the faster it's moving, the more damped it is. If you know enough to figure out how fast it's moving and how much it's damped, you can figure out how long it must be. It's basically what we're doing. So this is just, you know, the dissipation that goes with this. You do it at high amplitude, low amplitude. This high temperature part has nothing to do with amplitude. It's not breakaway. It has nothing to do with helium-3. It's due to phonons. So we work at high amplitude just so we don't have this stupid helium-3 pinning thing in the way, right? So we go to high amplitude, which is the same, just less noisy, and study this dissipation, because along with the part that gives you the prediction for the shear modulus, there's a part that has to do with damping. Right? So if you have damping, you have dissipation, right? So this is the dissipation, 1 over Q, 1 over the quality factor. And it basically has this frequency dependence of frequency times a damping constant that has to do with phonons times L squared. So if you know the frequency and know this damping constant somehow and do this measurement, you can find L separately from lambda L squared, which nobody had ever managed to do before. So we did that, all right? So here it is. If you take this expression for damping, this B has been calculated for phonons in a crystal, calculated 40 years ago. And it just involves, you know, the speed of sound and Boltzmann's constant and Planck's constant, a few things. It goes like T cubed. It's phonons. That's the density of phonons, the number of phonons in a crystal as a function of temperature. So what you expect is a damping that's proportional to frequency and T cubed. And so this is one particular frequency, but you could do it at different ones. So that's the question, is that what you see? And so here's a bunch of data like this, plotted versus omega t cubed, the expected behavior in this axis, and you see three different, completely different frequencies at low temperature, at least, all fall in the same thing, and it's nice linear behavior. So sure enough, it is this omega t cubed, it is thermal phonons. Now that we know what it is, we can turn it around and figure out what the length is. And what we find is that the lengths are almost macroscopic, hundreds of microns, very long, right? So you have to think of this, even though it's a crystal microscopic thing, it's got these little vibrating stringy things that vibrate when you stress it, that move relatively large distances, and you can oscillate them at tens of kilohertz. And when you do that, you realize they're flying back and forth through the crystal, these defects, at centimeters per second, which is a relatively pretty high speed, right? It's going over many, 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 many of these atomic scale Pirrell's valleys every oscillation. So they do it very freely. I think I'll just pass on this. One of the things that we did do, I won't go through it, but I'll just explain, is that the collection of helium-3s on these things is thermally activated. You know, as you go lower and lower temperature, they're bound, more and more of them do that, et cetera. And they unbind, and there's some time constant associated with that. There were some discrepancies between a few other labs that did this and whether there was a frequency dependence to do with that. And the most recent thing, which we, I think, just submitted, was that you look at this frequency dependence and et cetera in a great deal of detail. And if you analyze it the right way, now that we can calculate how fast the dislocations are moving, right? For any given frequency and amplitude, having done all this, we know how long they are, we know how many times per second we're oscillating them, we know how fast they're moving. And when you analyze all of the data, all of the frequencies and all of the amplitudes, there's a region that below a dislocation speed of about 45 microns per second where it has one type of behavior, thermally activated, and above it, it does not. This has to do with helium-3 pinning. So even though I'm not going to explain it in any detail, this is kind of our best answer to Michelle's question, which is that this is the motion of the helium-3s. There's a crossover in whether the helium-3s really do pin the dislocation. They do if you try to move it too fast. But if you do it nice and slowly and gently, move them slower than 45, they follow along. They do move. They sort of hop or quantum tunnel and follow it. So there's apparently a critical speed. And all I can say for critical speeds of that is if you take a helium-3 impurity in a classical crystal, it can exchange either thermally at high temperature or by quantum tunneling. You can exchange this one and this one, right? It can happen. And you got that. And if you do it thermally, it'll just go here and go there, a little later. It depends on temperature. But there's a quantum tunneling parameter associated with this, which is independent of temperature. So it ballistically goes. This is well known in helium. These things are completely delocalized particles flying even at zero temperature at millimeters per second, actually, right? You take the tunneling frequency, they're impurities in a narrow band, they have a ballistic speed of the order of millimeter per second, maybe a little bit lower, and we suspect that this critical speed is, for example, related to the speed at which this helium-3 can just tunnel ballistically and follow the dislocation. If you try to go faster than that, it's not going to be able to follow, right? And it'll look like a pinning center. So that's our best guess at present, that this is a quantum effect due to the quantum nature of the helium-3 impurities. The obvious sort of next step is turn it around, grow beautiful helium-3 crystals and put helium-4 in and see if it behaves the same, because it should not. The helium-4 can't tunnel in helium-3 because helium-3 has spin disorder and is not periodic. Okay, so just a really quick summary of what I've said. So we now know, as of, say, a year and a half ago, that we're absolutely convinced that we know which dislocations are moving and responsible for all of this. They move at low temperature. We can see no sign of dissipation, no sign of a critical stress to move them. They move essentially perfectly freely, as best we can say in our experiments. We know that there's a whole distribution of lengths. We have a pretty good idea of how many there are in particular crystals and how they're connected. They move a long way really fast with no problems at all, and that it looks like helium-3s are interacting with them as a quantum dislocation. And just the last thing is, if we're looking for future things to do, one of the questions, and they're working really hard in Paris as I speak, is to see just how perfect a crystal you can grow. If you can get rid of all helium-3, we believe we can do that. If you can get rid of almost all dislocations. And it's going to be interesting because as you get fewer and fewer dislocations, the effect of them gets bigger and bigger. A highly annealed, high-quality crystal is softer than a defect one, but a one with no dislocations is hard. So if you can get a region that you can probe that has none, then you should go back to being a very stiff, intrinsic crystal. We want to see, for example, as I said, in helium-3, if this all reverses, because that's a clear signature of a quantum effect if statistics matter, right? And then there's really questions about what we can do with plasticity, but thank you.